Your guide to Merseyside sport. The kickoff.
Radio City Talk.
So the A to Z of Merseyside football resumes with John Keith. And today we're moving on to the Fs. And as you would imagine, there's some fairly big Fs to cover off. So we'll just do a couple today and next week. But we've got to start with an absolute legend of the game. Someone who you knew very well, John.
Yes, starting with the redoubtable Joe Fagan, Steve. Or Smoking Joe, as some nicknamed him for his partiality to a cigarette. When he took over as Liverpool manager, he was aged 62 in the summer of 1983. And I suppose it was akin to walking on stage after Frank Sinatra. Just how do you follow a genius called Bob Paisley? Well, Joe came up with a way. He landed the first treble in the history of English football, leading the club to the league title, the European Cup and the League Cup in his first season in charge. And that came 15 years before Alex Ferguson won three trophies in a season with Manchester United. Paisley, though, had seen it coming because I was there when he told the manager of the year lunch in London shortly after his retirement, "The man who's following me is even hungrier for success. Fagan's his name and he won't need any help from the artful Dodger."
Is that what he said?
That's what Bob told the assembled ranks of the at the lunch, yeah, which was lovely and so true, of course. Joe was of Irish descent. He was born in Walton Hospital in March 1921. He lived in Lidland and the Scotland Road area during his formative years. His football skills developed to the point where he joined Earlstown Bohemians after leaving school at 14, turning in displays at centre-half, which had Liverpool and Everton on his trail. But heeding advice that local boys were sometimes the first to receive terse criticism if things didn't go all that well, he joined Manchester City as a 17-year-old in 1938. And after his career went on hold due to the Second World War, when hostilities ended, he established himself in the City defence, eventually being appointed captain. He made a total of 158 appearances for City, scoring twice. He left in August 1951 for spells at non-league Nelson and Bradford Park Avenue and Altrincham, returning to Nelson as player-manager prior to joining Rochdale as assistant, and this is a key in Joe's career, as assistant to future Everton boss Harry Catterick in 1956. And ironically, it was thanks to Catterick that Fagan arrived at Anfield pre-Bill Shankly in 1958. Harry sent a letter of recommendation of Joe for a coaching job at Liverpool, and it was taken up by then boss Phil Taylor, and that started Joe's 27-year Anfield career, in which he worked with Shankly, Paisley, Ronnie Moran, Tom Saunders and Roy Evans, amongst others. And of course, another great claim to fame by Joe, it was he and Bob Paisley who founded the Boot Room. And this was a response to Guinness export manager Paul Orr's supply of the black brew as a thank you to Joe and Bob for treating his players. So this supply of crates of Guinness arrived at Anfield.
Was that their tipple, all of them?
Well, yes. And, of course, Paul Orr was manager of Guinness Export, so it was their product. So he sent crates and crates of this stuff. And Bob said to Joe one day, "Where on earth are we going to store all this stuff, Joe?" So Joe said, "Put them in the boot room, Bob." So that's where it went. And that started this amazing story in one of the most hallowed, celebrated spaces in the world of football, which it's ever seen. The boot room just became legend of legends. And I think every player who's passed through Anfield during the Joe Fagan years will pay testimony to his influence, including Tommy Smith, who told the story shortly after he'd signed pro. He refused to brush the dressing room, saying that wasn't a job for professionals. Suddenly, Tommy related, a calm but stern voice behind him said, "Son, pick up that brush and do as you're told." And it was Joe. And Tommy said, "I couldn't pick up the brush quick enough because you didn't argue with Joe."
Wow. And if Tommy Smith is bowing to someone,
doesn't that just tell its own story? Yeah. And talking about brushes, Steve, I'll never forget the game that clinched the 1984 championship for Joe. It was a goalless draw at Notts County, and myself and several other football writers reached the Liverpool dressing room. There was Joe sweeping the floor and deflecting remarks that it wasn't quite what title-winning managers were expected to do. He said, "It's a job that has to be done, so I'm doing it. That's the way we are at Liverpool." There he was, brushing
Madness.
The dressing room.
He had a brush on his own. There was no one else
there
in
were
there.
There were only a few players left, and I think one of the cleaners as well was in there, but he was brushing the dressing room.
And did that say something about his personality?
Yeah. definitely.
And what was? I mean, you know, talked about the boot room. You had the good cop, which was Roy, and obviously Ronnie was a bit of a shouter, and you know, Bob was a bit quieter.
Joe was the calm, hard man. Nobody argued with Joe. And he had a wonderful disposition. He never shouted, but he used authority, Steve. And he was a man without any pretensions. He lived with his wife, Lil, in a modest house from which he could walk to Anfield. He never moved. And once at a game on Saturday at Anfield, we asked if we could be a press call arranged for the Sunday. And Joe told the media, "I'm taking a day off from football. I'm painting the back kitchen." And that was the modesty of the man, the humbleness of the man, you know, the humility, I should say. But his homespun attitude couldn't mask his shrewd eye for talent, underlined by his signings of players Jan Mulby, John Walk, Gary Gillespie, Paul Walsh, Kevin MacDonald, amongst many others. But during his second season as manager, and now aged 64, Joe told Liverpool he wanted to step down and retire at the end of that campaign. And of course, I think most people know the tragedy for Joe, that his 2 years in charge ended with the horror of the Heysel disaster at the 1985 European Cup final against Juventus. Mm. And he sadly walked away in tears and anguish, which was a cruel end to a distinguished Anfield career. He died aged 80 in June 2001, assured of a permanent place in Liverpool's roll of honour. And I think perhaps Roy Evans provided the best tribute to him when he said, "Joe was the guy who held everything together. He was respected like no other, but given the least praise." So I hope we've told people that he certainly deserves his place in our Hall of Fame and the A to Z, Steve.
And when we've talked about Bob Paisley in the past, we've said, as he had the recognition he deserves. I think that's possibly a question you could ask about Joe as well.
Yeah, he even gets sort of airbrushed out of the history books when people talk about trebles. As I said in the early in the piece, 15 years before Man U did it, he won the first manager ever to win three major trophies in English football history.
If he'd have had a long run of being Liverpool manager, would he have had the similar sort of success that Bob had enjoyed?
I think he would. I mean, given all things being equal, I think he would have done. I mean, he took the job at quite an age, and I don't think he wanted the job like Bob didn't want the job, but he took it on. But he knew he's not going to take it on for very long, and it was just so terribly tragic it ended like it did. A lot of people make the mistake of thinking he quit because of Heysel, but he told them months before. It was just so sad that his final game was that game.
How did he make you press boys feel?
Generally,
welcome.
During his...
Yeah.
Oh, yes, yeah. Because like Bob, he wasn't used to dealing with the media, but he adapted to it quicker than Bob did. Joe was a very adaptable guy, and he could see situations and respond to them. And he also had a wonderful little line. He could come up with lines, which, of course, as you know, the media love. And talking about that dressing room when he was sweeping it, as he was sweeping the floor after winning the title, he said, "You know, lads," he said, "I never saw Manchester United as a threat." Which is a lovely throwaway line for Monday, you know.
You did a lovely little impression there. Now, normally with your Paisleys and your Shankleys, you do a lot more. Did Joe just not have a voice that was prominent?
He had a sort of a Liverpool voice, but not a thick Scouse voice. He sort of talked like that, you know, lad. It was a little bit of Lancashire in it because he was years at Manchester City, you see. But he was a great guy, Joe. I've never heard anyone say a bad word about him.
The great Joe Fagan. Right, our second F isn't a person.
It isn't a person, Steve. It's floodlights. Now, I know that might sound a bit banal, but there's something everyone takes for granted now. But we were more than halfway through the 20th century before the FA gave permission for competitive games to be played under lights, even though Everton had been nicknamed the Moonlight Dribblers when arc lights were erected at their Anfield home. Yes, the Moonlight Dribblers. When arc lights were erected at their Anfield home for an experimental period in 1890. They didn't last long. But then non-league South Liverpool, there's another first for Merseyside, they became the first in England to host a game under permanent floodlights when they played a friendly at the Holly Park ground against the Nigerian 11 way back in 1949. But the first floodlit games under permanent lights at Goodison and Anfield were staged in October 1957, when Everton and Liverpool, then in Divisions 1 and 2 respectively, met home and away for a trophy called the Floodlit Cup. listen to this, it drew a combined attendance of 105,000 people for the two legs. Everton won the first leg at Goodison 2-0. Liverpool came out on top 3-2 at Anfield, so on aggregate 4-3. Everton won the one-off trophy and we were into a new illuminated football age.
The floodlight champs. I remember going in the 80s thinking these floodlights aren't bright enough. Yeah. God knows what it was like in the 40s with some floodlights.
I remember I actually saw those two games in October 57. I was only a youngster. And when you compare the illumination then to what it is today, it was almost pitch black, but just enough to see the game. I mean, the technology of lighting, of course, has just gone through the roof, hasn't it? It's superb now. It's better than daylight, of course, isn't it?
John, thank you very much indeed. The A to Z of Merseyside football, we've covered off Joe Fagan and floodlights today. Next up next week, we're talking Duncan Ferguson and Tommy Fairfowl. What a great name. Tommy Fairfowl, as if there's such a thing. We'll do that next week. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Steve.
Steve Hoddersall's kick-off.
This is Radio City Talk.